It's a Saturday morning already. Hello, Dr. Ross. How are you?
Oh, g'day, mate. Lovely to talk to you. I'm very well, thank you.
I hope you had a good week.
Very busy week, but weeks are always good.
Let's start our weekend, as always, with a couple of listener questions. In fact, more than a couple. We've got quite a few this week, Ross.
Okay, well, let's get through them.
Annie says, I'm 62 years old with osteoporosis. Under an endocrinologist, my vitamin D was 40 in August, so I've doubled my intake. Given your advice, Dr. Ross, against calcium supplements, is it still appropriate to take Ostalin Cal DK2, 600 milligram calcium, 25 milligram vitamin D3, 180 milligram K2, or should I switch to separate vitamin D and K2? If so, any dosage recommendations? I've also just completed my third zoledronic acid infusion.
Well, I'll go through all of those. And firstly, let me make the point. An endocrinologist is a gland specialist. So they're people who are specialists in diabetes, thyroid disease, but they're also experts in the management of osteoporosis as well. But where I disagree with most endocrinologists is that there has been a meta-analysis of 100 different studies put together asking two questions. One, do oral calcium supplements in the form of calcium carbonate, which is what's in most of these calcium supplements, does it improve or prevent osteoporosis? And the second question, does it stop bone fractures? And the answer is for both of them, no. So what's the point? And is there any risk in taking oral calcium supplements? Well, a big meta-analysis out of New Zealand, the University of Auckland, showed that if you do take calcium supplements over a long period of time, there is a higher rate of heart attack, possibly a 30% increased risk of heart attack in some studies, although one big study out of Spain said that wasn't the case. So what I'm saying is it doesn't appear that oral calcium does anything. I think people should be getting their calcium through dairy sources, not through chalk, oral chalk that you swallow. So in Annie's case, I would strongly suggest she takes 2,000 international units of vitamin D every day and 180 micrograms of vitamin K2 every day. Keep up her exercise. The zoledronic infusion is a thing called a bisphosphonate. That's okay. There's some work that shows that does help osteoporosis. My own preferred pharmaceutical therapy is Prolia, so a Prolia subcutaneous injection every 6 months. I think that's a bit more effective and a bit safer than the zoledronic acid, but still, it's a good legitimate way to manage osteoporosis. It's much better than doing nothing.
There you go, Annie. John is next. John's on the Gold Coast. He said, I was recently diagnosed with a small scalp tumour identified as osteomycotis. About 12 months ago, I underwent two treatments of Effudex on my scalp following the removal of an SCC.
Yep.
Could the use of Effudex have contributed to the condition, and are there any available treatments?
Yeah, none that I'm aware of, and I think that this is a very Mickey Mouse dermatologic question, but certainly Effudex is a standard treatment for SCCs and for people who have precancerous lesions on their face or on their scalp, so it's a legitimate thing to do. But one of the potential complications would be the development of secondary, even non-malignant tumours, such as the one that John's described. But again, these are questions much better directed towards a dermatologist who deals with this all the time. I'm not an expert in skin disease at all. I have to see the lesions. I have to see the biopsy results. There's no evidence of cancer on the biopsy results. But again, the dermatologist will know what to do in this situation. But yes, John's right. It may be a consequence of the Effudex therapy. But Effudex, again, standard of care for the sort of conditions that John has.
Leslie, 78, with congestive heart failure, a replaced mitral valve, AF, and stage 4 metastatic melanoma in her spine.
Okay.
After radiation and Keytruda, she said, I've been in remission for 4.5 years.
Yep.
I also take hydrocortisone for my adrenal gland, but my stomach is constantly bloated, and I can't lose weight despite exercising daily. Dr. Ross, is there such a thing as steroid belly? Leslie says it's embarrassing, and I'm buying larger clothes, and it gets costly. I also take thyroxine and heart medications. What else can I do to manage my weight?
Yeah, look, She has what's called adrenal failure or Addison's disease, which is why she needs the hydrocortisone for that condition. But the problem is that it does give you a bloated belly, it does give you fat around the belly, and it can give you a moon face. So JFK allegedly had Addison's disease as well, and he was on hydrocortisone replacement therapy. And she's got a whole lot of other medical conditions as well, the cardiac failure, the post-mitral valve replacement, atrial fibrillation. The melanoma, interestingly, she's had the radiotherapy to her spine and had Keytruda. Jimmy Carter, the ex-American president, he had cerebral melanoma about 10 years ago, was put on Keytruda and is still alive. I think he's over 100 now, so it's quite amazing stuff. But I wish I had some magic for Leslie, but it's vital she has the hydrocortisone. If she stopped it, she could go into severe hypotension where her blood pressure dropped. But unfortunately, one of the complications is that there is some bloating around the stomach. And short of the things like this, Ozempic and those sort of things, which may give a weak benefit, there's not much else she can do because she does need the hydrocortisone.
Michael has a short but brief question.
Yep.
Tautology there, short but brief.
Yeah.
Michael says, do tight hamstring muscles cause lower back pain and knee problems?
I think it's probably a bit of everything added together. Knee problems can cause tight hamstrings and can cause lower back pain. Lower back pain can be radiate some pain down to your knees and make your hamstrings tight. So, no, I wouldn't say that tight hamstrings are actually causing the problem. I just think they're part of the whole issue.
Sam wants to know, he said, we often hear about a mother's past life cycle choices and it can impact the health of her children. He said, I'm curious about the father's role. For instance, can marijuana use affect sperm in a way that could potentially cause issues for future offspring?
That's a great question. The answer is absolutely. And in fact, one study that came out of the US showed that a male that smokes one joint a week, so it's not a lot of marijuana, there's a significant increase in congenital abnormalities in their children. So any marijuana, look, I think if people are thinking about getting pregnant or in the age where either the male or the female is thinking about having a child, or if the male's in a long-term relationship with someone else, they shouldn't be smoking marijuana because it is a poison. I'm a great believer in medical cannabis, and I think medical cannabis has got a tremendous place in medical management. Unfortunately, at the moment, there's been a bit of abuse of the prescriptions of medical cannabis on the market, and so a lot of GPs who are authorised prescribers are now being investigated by the federal government for over-prescription. But used appropriately, medical cannabis is great, but smoked, especially when you're younger and thinking about having children, is A, bad for your brain. So the younger you start, the more damage to your brain in the long term, and B, there's a much higher rate of congenital abnormalities, and C, if you smoke anything, you damage your lungs. So three joints a day can cause the same degree over 10 years damage to your lungs as 20 cigarettes a day for 20 years. Let me also say, however, because it's a terrific question, there's a couple of really interesting studies. One is around the Dutch hunger winter, which occurred during the famine in the 40s when the Nazis invaded Holland. And I think it was the northwest part of Holland, and some of the listeners may be able to correct me if I'm wrong on this one, but the northwest part of Holland, there was an incredible famine because the Nazis withheld food for that area. And the grandchildren of the people born in that time had ongoing issues with obesity and diabetes if their grandparents were malnourished, whether it be grandfather or grandmother. And there's another study called the Overcalic study. The Overcalic study was done on a community that was 1,000 kilometres north of Stockholm in Sweden. And these people have been followed, I think, since the late 1890s. And again, they found there, if the grandfather was starved or didn't eat a lot of food up to puberty, then their grandsons would have a much higher rate of obesity and cardiovascular disease. And the same thing happened for the grandmothers. So with the granddaughters. So some really interesting things where the sins of the father, the sins of the mother, even the sins of the grandfather and grandmother may affect the children down the track. I'm not always saying it's sins, but just what you do up to conceiving children can have a profound effect on your children and even on your grandchildren.
There you go, Sam. Thank you. Great question. Finally, in our listener questions, Graham asks, I've had recurring gastritis for the past 7 years, leading to reflux. Despite trying various diets, medications, and seeing numerous doctors, nothing's worked. Recently, I've been seeing a gut hypnotherapist and started taking the following. 20 grams of marine collagen, 20 grams of marine L-glutamine, something I don't know, I've never heard of, Ross. It's ashwagandha.
Ashwagandha is a herb that is associated with stress relief, better sleep. So, it's being used a lot now in a lot of different herbal preparations.
And there's 380 milligrams of propolis.
Yep.
He said, I'm feeling better than I have in a long time, but how long can I safely continue these supplements?
As long as he likes. The only concern I have in somebody who has gastritis is that if they haven't gone down the initial medical route of having a gastroscopy to have a biopsy of their stomach to see what's going on. And also, a lot of people are taking aspirin as a preventative, and they don't realise that aspirin can also cause a chronic gastritis as well. So I'd like to know whether Graham is taking aspirin, because that's something he should not be taking. And if he needs a blood thinner, there is a drug called clopidogrel that still thins the blood but doesn't irritate the stomach. So that aside, if he doesn't have a Helicobacter infection, which can cause a chronic gastritis, so you'd only know that by a biopsy to see whether there's Helicobacter in the stomach. The Helicobacter can be eliminated and fix up a whole lot of problems. But in terms of what he's taking, at the worst, he's blowing his dough. But at the best, if it's working, collagen, glutamine, ashwagandha, propolis, they're all very good supplements, and they're not going to hurt him to take them in the long term.
Okay, let's do some topics. A recent analysis of UK Biobank data found that drinking 3 cups of coffee daily reduced the risk of cardiometabolic diseases by 40 to 48%, while consuming over 4 cups increased stroke risk by 37%.
Yep.
Other studies showed coffee's potential benefits in reducing dementia risk, improving liver function, and no negative neurodevelopmental effects in children of pregnant women drinking up to 4 cups. However, moderation is always the key, with the ideal intake, they say, between 1 and 3 cups per day. Ross, what is the safe threshold of coffee for people with high blood pressure?
Firstly, can I say a beautiful summary of the article I wrote on this. So really, the safe threshold for coffee, whether you've got high blood pressure or not, is about 1 to 3 cups a day. And that's the sweet spot for health benefits. So there are a number of new studies just released on this. The one you mentioned from the UK Biobank, which is a rich source of data from about 500,000 people in varying guises, and this subset of 360,000 people, showed that if you had a history of something like type 2 diabetes, heart disease, or stroke, you double the risk of death. If you had more than one of those things, you could get up to 7 times the risk of death. But if you were a coffee drinker, up to 3 cups of coffee per day, you reduce the risk for any of those cardiometabolic diseases just below 50%. So it's quite profound data just on having a few cups of coffee a day. But as you say, there is a sweet spot, because once you get above 4 cups, then you increase your stroke risk. Coffee can also help with a bit of weight loss, but studies over the years have shown that 2 to 3 cups a day reduce your risk for gallstones, kidney stones, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, many common cancers, type 2 diabetes, depression, stroke, heart failure. And this study out of Norway, done by the University of Queensland, showed that there was no effect on a child's brain development in the mothers who drank coffee during pregnancy. But I've got to put a bit of a disclaimer on that one. There is still some evidence from some studies that mothers who drink coffee during pregnancy may have a higher rate of congenital abnormalities in their children. So although it doesn't appear that it affects the brain that much, it may affect other areas as well. So on the whole, for almost all of us, a few cups of coffee a day is a good thing, and it doesn't matter whether you have a coffee from a coffee shop with a bit of milk in it, or whether you have black coffee at home. It's across the board. It shows there's a benefit.
Are all these statistics thrown out the window if you drink decaffeinated coffee?
No. With decaffeinated coffee, you're still getting the polyphenols, or the plant chemicals in coffee, which are highly beneficial, whether it's decaf or not. So I don't really mind. For example, if you're very sensitive to coffee, so there are two types of people in society. In fact, my old grandfather used to say to me, Ross, he was a Queenslander, he said, there are two types of people in the world, Queenslanders and those who'd like to be. But in fact, there are two types of people in the world, people who are slow metabolizers of caffeine and people who are rapid metabolizers of caffeine. Now, I'm a slow metabolizer of caffeine. So if I drink coffee beyond about 3 or 4 o'clock, I don't sleep that well. Whereas I've got friends who can have a double shot latte before they go to bed and they sleep fine. So if you're a slow metabolizer of coffee, you are more sensitive to caffeine and so therefore may get all the problems with too much caffeine, which are palpitations, cardiac arrhythmias, feeling of anxiety. So it's best not to go overboard in the coffee department. But some people can have up to 3 to 4 cups a day and they feel fine.
An international team of researchers found that a probiotic-based supplement offers absolutely no significant relief for chronic constipation. In their study, over 200 patients received either the supplement or a placebo for 8 weeks, with no measurable difference in bowel movements reported between the two groups. Ross, what implications do the study's findings have for patients relying on probiotic supplements for constipation relief?
Well, all it's saying is that particular type of probiotic, the Bifido animalis, so one particular type of probiotic didn't do much for chronic constipation in the 200 people studied. It means absolutely nothing. I just find these sort of studies bizarre because people then have this distorted concept of therefore probiotics don't work. Well, no. It means that that particular probiotic doesn't work for chronic constipation, but that particular probiotic, the Bifido animalis, has been shown to have quite good effects for other aspects of health, improving leaky gut, also having some effects on blood pressure and weight. So it just irritates me a bit where these studies are published and they're not qualified. So all they're saying is if you have functional constipation, and functional constipation is really stress-related constipation, there's no real reason why you're constipated. Just in your case, your bowels don't work that well and stress might make it worse. All they're saying is this particular type of probiotics probably won't help you.
Researchers at Stanford University have developed a small molecular tag that allows chemotherapy drugs, typically given via IV, to be taken as effective oral pills.
Yep.
In initial trials with mice, their oral version outperformed standard IV doses, potentially transforming cancer treatment and improving patient access to care. How could the development of oral chemotherapy drugs impact the overall treatment experience for cancer patients, Ross?
Well, it's quite extraordinary, really, because one of the problems, if you have to have things intravenously, because all of these cancer drugs need to be given intravenously because they're so toxic if you injected them just as a subcutaneous injection, and you can't swallow the normal proteins because the proteins get broken down in the stomach anyhow, so they're completely ineffective. So what these geniuses at Stanford have done, just quite extraordinary stuff, developed this small molecular tag that carries the drug through the stomach and protects it against being broken down by the stomach acid and allows it to be absorbed effectively into the body at much lower doses than you'd give intravenously. So not only is it just as effective, but it's less toxic because you're using lower doses. So this is all this nanotechnology that's being discovered. And I spoke on my show a few months ago about a study out of the University of Norway, University of Sydney, where they've developed an oral insulin that actually works better in the animal models of diabetes they've studied than does having an injectable insulin. Because when you think about it, the way insulin works is being released from the pancreas locally when you eat food, and it regulates sugar metabolism that way. But if you inject yourself into the tummy, it's just got to go all through the body to have an effect locally in the pancreas and around that area. Whereas if you swallow something, it's absorbed directly into the liver and it works better. So interestingly, with this oral insulin they've developed, there was much less hypoglycemia where the sugar drops, and it was just as effective as using injectable insulin at lower doses and given locally. So we're getting so much better targeted therapy than we've had over the past 20 years. We're moving into, a revolution in medicine. There's a thing called Moore's Law that you would have heard of, that computer power doubles every 18 months. I believe medical research is doing exactly the same thing. The power of medical research is doubling every 18 months.
And I think on that note, we'll let you go. Thank you, as always, for answering our listener questions. Have a great weekend, and we look forward to catching up with you next weekend, Ross.
Look forward to it, mate. Lovely to talk to you.